Guess what? You know how we used to censor certain words with a little beep? As if you, the listener, didn't know exactly what word it was we were beeping. As if beeping it made it just go away like it never ever existed. As if beeping it didn't actually draw more attention to it than if we just didn't. Well, from now on, we're just going to not. These infants are now explicit. Go tell your mom. That's what.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
When I was a kid growing up, as I did in the Mormon church, I used to hear references to Mormonism all around me, even when they weren't really there. Take this song, for instance. What lyric do you hear? Okay, this is Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and what it actually says is, I have been around the world looking for that woman slash girl. But of course, what I heard was, I've been around the world looking for that Mormon girl. Eh? Or how about Instant Karma from John Lennon? What's this all about? Well, we all shine on, like the moon and the stars and the sun. We all shine on like the moon and the stars and the sun. This is about the degrees of glory, man. And one more just to complete my three pattern. Someone's knocking at the door. Somebody's ringing the bell. Do me a favor. Open the door. Sister Susie, Brother John. I mean, this is what we call each other at church, right? And who else would be knocking on the door or ringing the bell except the missionaries? See, when I was a kid, I wanted outside validation of my Mormonism so badly that I would make it up even when it wasn't really there. So imagine how excited I would get when I would actually hear an outsider really talk about Mormonism. And it didn't even matter if they got it a little wrong. It was all okay. I just wanted them to acknowledge that we were. But what happens when the insider suddenly realizes that he could learn a thing or two from what the outsider has to say? I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today on Infants on Thrones, I'm joined by panelist Jesse Smith and Randy Snyder to discuss an outsider's view of Mormonism. So here's how this discussion evolved. There's a YouTube video out there of Brandon Flowers, the lead singer of The Killers, appearing on some Norwegian talk show. They talk to him a little bit about religion. They talk to him about Mitt Romney. He's getting a little annoyed because that's not really what he's there to talk about. And then they bring out Richard Dawkins, the world-famous atheist, and he starts attacking the Book of Mormon, and Brandon Flowers gets a little defensive. Well, I saw this when it first came out around September 2012, and my first reaction, well, I thought that Dawkins was way out of line. And so a month or so ago, I talked with the fellow infants and asked who wanted to have a discussion about this, really a debate about Dawkins and his tactics. But as I went back and I watched it again, this time I came away with a very different reaction. I thought that Brandon Flowers was actually the one that was a little out of line. Or maybe not out of line as much as just really defensive. But he did kind of get set up. So let me play two clips for you. The first is the host of the Norwegian show asking Brandon Flowers about the beauty of faith. And it's a leading question. He asks him about the beauty of faith. And so Brandon responds. And then the second clip is a few minutes later when they bring in Richard Dawkins and the host asks him what he thought listening to Brandon's response about the beauty of faith, and the fireworks, if you call it that, then ensue.
You are actually a Mormon, and you've been a Mormon also for your whole life. Mm-hmm. Can you please explain the beauty of faith
to of people here?
He's an atheist.
The beauty of faith. Some of the things that I love are, I think about my mother teaching me to pray and that I had that communication with my Heavenly Father. And that's something that I turn to on a daily basis. And just there are answers to questions that my church has that I, you know, that also are very, I guess it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing for me, and I'm happy.
I think that the world is explained fully by science, or will be explained fully by science. There is no evidence for any kind of supernatural being of any kind, and so that it goes against the spirit of science to put your trust in the supernatural when the natural explanation is there, and so much more fun and so much more exciting and so much more interesting.
Even though you say that, still people believe.
Well, a lot of people don't know the facts. A lot of people are simply ignorant of science, and that's no fault of theirs. It's probably the fault of us scientists. But
isn't it also, when you listen to Brandon here explaining what's for him the beauty of religion, the beauty of believing, isn't this a profound need we have, like a genetic need?
I think there may well be a profound need to understand. And the satisfaction that you get from genuine understanding, which comes from science, is so much greater. I mean, there is far more beauty in a real understanding of the reality of nature than there is in reading some ancient book, or than reading some modern book, which is what the Book of Mormon is. And I have to say that when I read the Book of Mormon recently, I didn't read it all, what impressed me was that it's an obvious fake. I mean, this is a 19th century book written in 16th century English, and it came to pass, verily I say unto you, and things like that. That's not the way people talked in the 19th century. It's a fake. So it's not beautiful. It's a work of charlatanry.
You're free to answer.
The book's been studied and torn apart and looked at, and I'm not one of the professors that have done it.
Yeah. But do you believe?
For you to call this man a charlatan, I do. I take offense to it.
And he was a convicted charlatan. No, he was a convicted con man.
No, these are all falsehoods. You should do your research.
Well, I think I have.
Yeah, you have.
But look, we
have almost read the book.
Obviously, different information. Yeah. But before we continue, actually, I have to throw you out. I don't mean to interrupt the debate. It could be a wonderful debate with you about the Book of Mormon the whole night.
Yeah.
But you're going to play for us in a short while.
Yes.
So while I finish up with Mr. Dawkins here. The band would like you to come and get ready with them, okay?
All right.
Is that okay?
Join them. Yeah.
Good.
I'm so sorry. I didn't know you had to leave.
Yes, I know. And it's actually something you'd like to discuss, but anyway.
Maybe we could talk on the phone later.
Yeah, you're so welcome sorry. Back anytime to discuss
more. I'll
give
you some of the true history of
the
church.
I didn't realize you had to leave.
That's okay.
No, so that's why I'm
sorry. How's my audio, by the way? Is it okay?
Yeah. Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, so... You know, I came across this Brendan Flowers, Richard Dawkins thing kind of by accident several months ago. And I watched the YouTube video and I was kind of interested by it. I think, you know, like every once in a while you see these YouTube videos like so-and-so is schooled by this person or that. You know, I think it was one of those things that like popped up in a feed. And so I looked at it. And what I took away from it was that Dawkins had been kind of rude to Brendan Flowers. And so when I was talking, Randy, with you and Tom the other night, you know, I brought it up, you know, like, hey, we should look into this and maybe talk about it a little bit. And then I went back and watched it, and I didn't think that Dawkins was really rude at all. I mean, he kind of mocks a little bit, you know, he does the whole verily, verily, and makes fun of the language of the Book of Mormon. He's very decisive in calling the Book of Mormon an obvious fraud. And Brendan Flowers gets pretty defensive about it. But I kind of was more taken aback by Flowers' reaction. What interests you guys about this exchange?
Well, what interests me, I just sent you my little brief five-part summary. But basically, yeah. I think Brendan Flowers has a pretty typical reaction to being confronted mm-hmm. by this. You know, the first thing he says is, well, yeah, I believe it. I really believe it. And I have looked into it. You know, this is before Dawkins even comes on. One of the hosts is asking him about whether or not he really believes in the Book of Mormon. And, you know, he gets kind of defensive and says, yeah, I've really dug into my church history and that sort of thing.
Yeah, he said I'm aware of my church's history. Yeah, you know, right, something like that. Yeah.
Now, my question for you was, I'm curious to know: do you actually literally believe in the story about Joseph Smith and the gold plates and the hat and everything?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the origins of my religion, and I've read about it. You get to that age where you have to, you know, your parents teach you something, and you've got to decide once you're an adult, you know. You can't just go off of what they said. You have to gain a testimony for yourself. And I do. I believe Joseph Smith.
Right, which about 2 minutes later, it's obvious he's not. And then as soon as Dawkins asks him...
What do you think he was responding to in that moment when he said that he was aware of the history?
I think he's just, you know... generally aware that outsiders are going to question the church origins.
Yeah, he actually referred to in the interview before Dawkins came out, which, by the way, was for like a rock star, he's a really boring interview. He didn't have much to say that was interesting at all with any of the questions that they had. It was tedious. He called the Mormon Church one of the most misunderstood religions. And to me, yeah, the Mormon Church is clearly one of the most misunderstood religions, but it's by its own members.
Yeah.
They are completely oblivious to any kind of scholarly research that's been done on the history. And I was the same way. I was the exact same way. Many times on my mission, I was confronted by people who knew more than me about the church history. And I had the exact same reaction as Flowers did, that, you know, hey, you think I'd go on my mission for 2 years and not know about my church's history? Yeah, I know the true history. You may be getting your sources or your information from sources like anti-Mormon literature, but I know the real history, and I wouldn't do this if I didn't.
Yeah, that's kind of what I read into his response, and I think it was because the guy mentioned the hat, you know, that that the Book of Mormon had been translated by looking into a hat, which goes against the typical narrative that you hear growing up, you know, with the Urim and Thummim, but was obviously made very prominent through South Park. And so to me, and I could be misreading it, but I thought that's what really tipped Brandon Flowers into defensive mode, was when he heard the hat, and he's like, yeah, I know what the real history is.
Yeah, he probably thinks that the South Park episode and references to a top hat with a seer stone is anti-Mormon lies. You know, because he knows that Joseph used the Urim and Thummim and went line by line behind the curtain and translated, you know, literally. I honestly, based on everything he said and the facial expressions were priceless.
Right.
Yeah, no kidding.
I could just see his mouth getting dry.
Here, I'll give you some audio. You can insert this here, Glenn.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that's dry mouth?
Yeah, that was the sound of dry mouth.
That sounded quite moist. I mean, I know there's going to be people out here who hate the word moist, but that's what it sounded like to me.
I'll dry it again. Here we go.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Take it or leave it.
Yeah.
No, but I thought it was interesting. As soon as he was asked about the Book of Mormon by Dawkins, he said, you know, experts have torn it apart.
Right.
And there's been these professors, and he never got to the implicit part of that, which was they've torn it apart and it's held up to scrutiny, because in his mind, it's like he doesn't even have to say it. But what I'm sitting there thinking is, you're right, they have torn it apart, and it's shredded, and it's all over the place.
Well, right, but I imagine that he's thinking about lessons that he received in seminary or in Sunday school, where you're told that, you know, scholars like Hugh Nibley have gone through the Book of Mormon and have validated that this is really an ancient text, you know, and there's all this apologist... I don't know what you call it out there that make links to, You know, they've got their bullseyes here and there. And you know, that's what you hear from a very faithful perspective. I think that's what he was leaning on. But
yeah, I mean, it's obvious that he has no clue what a non-Mormon scholar in any of the relevant fields would have to say about it. So that was his second point, was experts have torn it apart. His third point was, I'm offended that you would say that. His fourth point was, hey, get your facts straight, Dawkins. You don't know what you're talking about because you think Joseph Smith was a fraud.
Well, no, but that was specifically in reference to being a convicted felon.
Right, and to the fraud, yeah. It was 1826, and he was brought on charges of being a glass looker mm-hmm. and a disorderly person.
Yeah.
There's a really good article on Mormon Think, and we still have some of the period documents from the time.
Yeah.
And he was found guilty of that. And it specifically, if you look at the court records, if you look at the transcript of the court proceedings that's on Mormon Think, it talks about him using two different stones, the white stone that he would look at, and he would look at it, he would either put it up to the sun and look at the light that would shine through it, or he would put it next to a candle and look at the light that would shine through it, or he has a brown stone that he would put in his hat and he would put his face into the hat. So it's the same thing, it's the same process by which he translated the Book of Mormon, and there's witnesses there that are testifying in regards to it, and I mean it's an official court proceeding. He was found guilty of it. Now, it wasn't a big fine. I mean,
it wasn't big, but he was technically convicted. And but that's not what I learned growing up. You know, if you listen to the Truman G. Madsen tapes,
right,
he trumps that Joseph Smith was brought to court or to trial, and he'll list some impressive number, and he'll say he was never found guilty once. That's what I always believed, what I was always taught.
And just to interrupt Randy here, I don't have any audio of Truman G. Madsen or those Joseph Smith tapes. I listened to them all the time on my mission, and I loved that stuff. The guy sounded like He-Man. But I do have some audio of President Packer in 2008 speaking in general conference.
During his life, Joseph Smith was summoned to court over 200 times on all kinds of trumped-up charges. He was never convicted.
This is probably one of those situations where the truth isn't really helpful. But regardless, this is the type of information that faithful Mormons will hear and will repeat, as Brandon Flowers did in his discussion with Richard Dawkins.
So the fact that Brandon Flowers would be completely unaware that Joseph Smith was actually convicted once or found guilty once isn't surprising at all. And I do remember my previous point. it's kind of the MO of the true believing Mormon to be mollified when somebody tells them, well, someone really, really smart, like Hugh Nibley, has already looked into this and he doesn't have any problem with it. And you just kind of go, okay, scholars have looked at this, it's fine. And that's kind of what his whole reaction was of, you know, it's been torn apart. Yeah, it's been torn apart by Mormons, lifelong Mormons. and it's, they found impressive things like chiasmas. And it's, you know, it stood the test of time. But he doesn't understand that people outside have looked at it and are not impressed.
Well, you know, the thing that really jumped out to me when I watched this for the second time was the conviction that he had, that Brandon Flowers had, where he was completely wrong, and the way that he turned it into an attack of Dawkins, where he says, right, get your facts straight, you know, you need to do your research, you know, that kind of smugness,
Oxford right, professor who's an author and written books about religion. Come on, I mean, do some research.
Yeah,
I'm a musician here.
Yeah,
yeah, but he, you know, I mean, Dawkins was making a, I mean, and first of all, you got a celebrated international celebrity, professional debater going against, ignorant, naive rock star. It's not a fair fight, and but you know, when somebody takes, and it was a pretty direct attack by Dawkins, although it was with that British cordiality. it was a pretty direct attack on his truth.
And, yeah, right.
And so that was pretty natural human reaction. I mean, it's silly, but it's very human and natural. So, yeah.
Well, the point I wanted to make with it is that it struck a chord for me in I don't know exactly how to say this, because I started going through my faith crisis, if you want to call it a faith crisis, or, you know, the process of really closely examining my beliefs, because I never wanted to be in a position, or I never wanted to come across to people the way that Brandon Flowers came across to Dawkins. I never wanted to be that ignorant about my own history of the church, and especially with as much venom as he did, you know. So I kind of softened my stance, you know, where I would say, just like you mentioned earlier, Randy, you know, when you were a missionary and you would come across these confrontational arguments, you'd kind of defend it tooth and nail. I felt that too. And so at some point I started letting go of that and going, okay, I need to accept the fact that there might be things out there that I haven't come across. And so when I'm hearing somebody say something, I'll listen to it and then I'll research it. You know, to me, that was a really formative step in getting to where I am now, where I don't have that belief in the church anymore. Yeah. And I was wondering, was that similar for you guys?
I think that's what makes all the difference, is somebody who's willing to understand that, hey, there's things out there that I don't fully know about, and then having the bravery, the intellectual courage to be able to just look at it and then come to, you know, or reanalyze your conclusion after you've looked at new evidence. I mean, yeah. That's the difference between somebody who has that kind of critical thinking and somebody who doesn't. And that's not to say they're smarter or better, but, you know, I mean, there's people out there that can hear this stuff their whole life and they're never going to look into it.
Yeah.
I don't think any of the three of us would be here talking on this podcast if we didn't have that aspect of our personalities. I had an unusual experience at BYU where this religion professor kind of went rogue, and I had the great advantage of having this. He was only an adjunct professor, so it was a very small class in a, you know, building that didn't even have to do with, I mean, it was a tiny classroom. He didn't have a lot of students, and he was in the subject was church history, and he brought up the top hat as actual you know, church history.
What year was this roughly?
It was roughly 98.
Okay.
He brought up Fanny Alger. He brought up the papyrus being found and being shown to be an Egyptian funerary text from 1st century BCE. He brought up a lot of difficult issues, but he, you know, it was like a perfect example of inoculation. He, you know, said, yes, these are difficult things, but then he would bear his testimony. And it did two things. It inoculated me, which maybe, you know, probably gave me an extra 5 years in the church. But it also opened my eyes that what we're taught on Sunday isn't the whole truth. But I still had that TBM attitude that, you know what, there's nothing I can learn that could harm my testimony. So I wasn't afraid to go out and learn things. And then I read Rough Stone Rolling and learned about polyandry, and that started my faith crisis. If you never come to the point where you're willing to ask the question, is it possible the church isn't true, you will never even entertain this kind of information or these kind of thoughts.
Yeah, you have to, at least my experience with it, I had to open myself up to the possibility that maybe it isn't true. I had to kind of clear the balance on the scale so that it could actually go down. You know, there's that possibility in my mind. And, you know, Jesse, you used words to describe it like courage and bravery. And for me, at the time, at least, I described it more as humility. And really that what I was doing is I was taking a step back. I was almost putting up my hands in surrender to say, okay, all right, I'm going to listen to what you have to say. I'm going to explore this a little bit and put aside my predetermined conclusions here and try and weigh this as fairly as I can. And,
Those are not mutually exclusive. You can be humble and have courage and bravery, because you have to have the humility that you could be wrong. Second of all, you have to have the bravery to deal with the consequences if you're wrong.
Yeah.
So it takes a little of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you were willing, psychologically, subconsciously, you had gotten to the point where you were willing to say, look, I'm going to go where the evidence leads me. So whether that's a conscious, you know, you getting the gumption up to take that step, or whether it's just kind of part of your personality, I don't mean to attribute it to one or the other, but some part of you was ready to accept what was out there.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never really thought of it in terms of I was willing to go where the evidence led me. I was more interested in truly understanding, you know, so to put myself in Brandon Flowers' situation, if Richard Dawkins confronted me the way that he did, I would be very interested in understanding, why is Richard Dawkins so strong in his convictions? What is it that he knows that I don't? You know, not necessarily that I'm going to join him and agree with it, you know, move that direction myself, but where is he coming from? You know, that desire to really understand and accept, you know, his position, that there's more to it than just being able to dismiss it as, oh, he's just being anti-Mormon and he's done sloppy research, you know?
Right.
And for me, this
reaction was pretty much the exact same thing as what my first bishop told me when I, as I was going through my faith crisis, and I basically unloaded on my bishop and told him, you know, all my reasons for my change in belief, and talking to him about polyandry and the Book of Abraham. And
he didn't believe any of that stuff, and he probably said it came from anti-Mormon sources.
He straight up told me that Joseph Smith did not marry any other women who were married to other men. He just flat out told me I was wrong. And I'm like, okay, it's on the church's own website. I mean, it's not like nobody who knows what they're talking about has any debate about the underlying facts here, that these marriages, they weren't really marriages, but these relationships took place. There's no dispute about that. And he was just, I mean, and he's a smart guy. I mean, he's a medical doctor, very well thought of, smart guy, very nice person, but mentally there was a block there that he couldn't accept that possibility, or he wasn't ready to allow that question to come into his mind. And so he just had to block it out. And if that meant just dismissing the evidence outright to somebody who had, you know, clearly read about it and thought about it and been troubled by it, you know, that's what he was going to do. So
there's two tactics. You dismiss the person giving the evidence, and that's what Brandon Flowers did. He's like, you haven't done your research. And then there's just, once the evidence is presented, just dismissing it out of hand, you know, without actually addressing it.
Yeah, and then he used the reverse ad hominem of "I'm offended," which basically means, you know, what do you think I'm a dodo? That's what the Elder Holland quote, right?
Yeah,
because we're not a cult. I'm not an idiot. You know, I've read a couple of books and I've been to a pretty good school, and I have chosen to be in this church because of the faith that I feel and the inspiration that comes.
No, I'm not calling you a cult. I'm just saying that I've met people who used to be in the church.
I've met people. And if people want to call us a cult, they can call us a cult and you can call us a cult. But we are 14 million and growing. And I'd like to think that your respect for me would be enough to know that this man doesn't seem like a dodo.
So, but I, you know, listening to this video about the getting back to the glass looker, this conviction in 1826 that Joseph Smith had, there's a David Cross bit. I don't know if everybody knows who the comedian David Cross is. He's probably best well known for his part in Arrested Development. He was the Dr. Tobias Funke.
Is he the analrapist?
Yes, he's the analrapist and the never nude. So if you've seen the show, you'll know who we're talking about. But he has a bit where he goes into kind of this episode, and it really stands out to me how well, and for an outsider, you know, someone who doesn't understand church history, someone who doesn't get into the nuances, somebody who doesn't understand what the difference for a Mormon would be in polyandry or polygamy, or why would we care? You know, there's already golden plates, so why would we care if there were these seer stones? Because to them, those are both equally weird. Well, I think the issue of the 1826 conviction against Joseph Smith is something to them that is like objectively, it's objective evidence of him being a fraud.
About 180 years ago, a guy named Joseph Smith was a convicted fraud. He was convicted and served time in prison for defrauding a guy by claiming he could find silver buried underneath his property, which he never did, of course. But he had a peepstone that he would put in a hat, and then the hat would divinely tell him where to go, but he never found anything, so he went to jail. Anyway, when he got out of jail, he claims that an angel named Moroni... Yes, Moroni, that's what he said. No, he wasn't in Sha-na-na. Stop it. Okay. No, so the angel Moroni appeared before him and said God had picked him out to find these magic golden plates filled with Egyptian hieroglyphics that had been buried thousands of years ago just down the street from where you are now. And you're to go dig them up and then translate them. But nobody else is to see them, ever. Nobody, never, 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 never. Nobody but you, Joseph Smith. Nobody can see them. Nobody. And then... So Joseph Smith dug up the plates and then used his peepstone, and he's like, wait a second, if it's Egyptian hieroglyphics, how am I going to understand how to translate it? And then Moroni gave him, and I quote, magic glasses. So that he put on magic glasses, put the peepstone in his hat, talked to his wife and his neighbor, and dictated what eventually became the Book of Mormon, which oddly enough, coincidentally, had a lot of Masonic imagery and ideals and symbolism, because Joseph and his brother Hiram were Masons at the time. But that's from thousands of years ago, the plates. And then a bunch of people believed this, and that's why you can't go visit your dying lover. Sorry.
Okay, sorry. I've got to insert this here. I have to take responsibility since I was the one who introduced the David Cross clip here. He gets a couple of details wrong, and that's probably pretty obvious to most of our listeners. First of all, there was no evidence that Joseph Smith ever served any jail time for the fraud that he was specifically convicted of in 1826. There was just a fine, it was a misdemeanor, and he was found to be a disorderly person. He did serve jail time later, of course, but most of you probably know that. There was also no Masonic imagery in the Book of Mormon, contrary to what David Cross here says. He's probably conflating the Masonic influences in the Mormon temple, but that came much later than the Book of Mormon. If anything, the Book of Mormon at the time exhibits a lot of anti-Masonic influence, which Joseph Smith would have been swimming in, given the area that he was at. Also, Joseph Smith even tried to sell the copyright of the Book of Mormon to an anti-Masonic press prior to its being printed. Bottom line, people outside, these outsiders, usually they're not very particular with the details. I think people like Richard Dawkins probably do a better job than most, but a comedian trying to make a joke, he's not going to get hung up on whether or not the Masonic influences happen to come through the Book of Mormon, or whether they happen to come 10 or 12 or 13 years later in a temple ceremony. He's using this as a joke, and for most people out there, it probably doesn't really make much of a difference. Oh, I've been reading this book lately called Going Clear. It's about Scientology. It's written by Lawrence Krauss. Lawrence Wright.
Yeah.
Lawrence Wright. And they talk about L. Ron Hubbard a lot in the book. It's talking about Scientology. And there's all these examples of him, you know, committing these just outright frauds. Like, he was in the military, and he said he was in all these battles, and he got all these wounds. And turns out his military service was really mundane, and it's just totally embellished. Like, everything in his life is just totally misrepresented. And there's so many parallels to Joseph Smith that I can understand how, to somebody like me who's outside of Scientology, has no clue. I mean, all their all their doctrine is completely bizarre. So I don't know why any of it would be more bizarre to me than something else. But when I can see something in real life, you know, in secular life, where he's found to be not telling the truth, that seems very powerful to me.
And what one thing that Mormons don't really understand is the position they hold on the, you know, the world landscape of in the arena of thought to, you know, scholars out there in all the different fields. Mormonism is like exhibit A of obviously fraudulent bullshit. It is seen with such dismissive, I wouldn't say contempt, but almost like ridicule, you know, from Harold Bloom to Christopher Hitchens, to Richard Dawkins, to even Mark Twain. it's almost like the thing I love about Joseph Smith is he you know went out on a limb on so many things. You know, one of them was Champollion hadn't cracked the hieroglyphs, and so Joseph Smith felt safe in saying that he could translate them. And now, you know, so there's so many things that are falsifiable about Mormonism. One, because it's so recent and there's so much information around its origins, unlike Christianity. And two, because Joseph Smith was just so willing to make solid stands on things. So Mormons, I think their perspective is that the world misunderstands them, but they still hold a pretty high regard, or they're held in high regard by the outside world in most instances. And it's just not the case.
You're saying that Mormons think that they're held in higher regard than they really actually are. Yeah. No, I agree. And they have an inflated sense of their own importance in the world relative to what it actually is.
And like one of those Mormon myths that kind of feeds into that is you guys heard the myth that archaeologists in Mesoamerica use the Book of Mormon to find sites?
Yes.
I mean, God.
Well, there's even the Smithsonian Institute had to put out a letter to debunk that. I mean, there's an actual letter that they've posted online that says, you know, we've been asked if we use the Book of Mormon in doing our archaeological research, and we don't. So,
wow, I'm surprised that they would even draft a response to that.
That's
interesting.
It's there.
Are there any other places where Mormonism is referenced in kind of an interesting, you know, like shining the light, a new way of looking at Mormonism kind of way in popular culture? And I'm thinking of Julia Sweeney's Letting Go of God. Have you guys listened to that audiobook?
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
But she recounts the beginning of her faith crisis, you know, really starting with two missionaries knocking on her door.
Not too long ago, two Mormon missionaries came to my door. Two boys, each about 19, in white starched short sleeve shirts. And they had little name tags that identified them as official representatives of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they said they had a message for me from God. I said, a message for me from God? And they said, yes.
So she tells her story in a way that, you know, to me, she really draws the listener in. You know, like, I've shared this with believers, and they usually get a kick out of hearing about, you know, this experience, because you usually hear, you know, as insiders, you hear missionary stories, but it's always from, like, the faithful experience, the perspective. But, you know, she tells it from the other side, and you don't often get to hear that. So it's interesting to hear her talk about the missionaries, and especially all the details that she gives. And, you know, most she gets right, a few she gets wrong.
And they told me the story all about this guy named Lehi, who lived in Jerusalem in 600 BC. Now, apparently, in Jerusalem in 600 BC, everyone was completely bad and evil, every single one of them, man, woman, child, infant, fetus. And God said to Lehi, put your family on a boat and I will lead you out of here. And God did lead them. He led them to America. I said, America? from Jerusalem to America by boat in 600 BC? And they said, yes. Then they told me how Lehi and his descendants reproduced and reproduced, and over the course of 600 years, there were two great races of them, the Nephites and the Lamanites. And the Nephites were totally, totally good, each and every one of them, and the Lamanites were totally bad and evil, every single one of them just bad to the bone. Then, after Jesus died on the cross for our sins, on his way up to heaven, he stopped by America and visited the Nephites. And he told them that if they all remained totally, totally good, each and every one of them, they would win the war against the evil Lamanites. But apparently, somebody blew it, and the Lamanites were able to kill all the Nephites. All but one guy, this guy named Mormon, who managed to survive by hiding in the woods. And he made sure this whole story was written down in Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics chiseled onto gold plates, which he then buried near Palmyra, New York. Well, I was so into this story, I was just on the edge of my seat. I said, what happened to the Lamanites? And they said, well, they became our Native Americans here in the U.S. And I said, so you believe the Native Americans are descended from a people who were totally evil? And they said, yes. Then they told me how this guy named Joseph Smith found those buried gold plates right in his backyard. And he also found a magic stone back there that he put into his hat and then buried his face into. And this allowed him to translate the gold plates from the Reformed Egyptian into English. Well, at this point, I just wanted to give these two boys some advice about their pitch. I wanted to say, okay, don't start with this story. I mean, even the Scientologists know to start with a personality test before they start telling people all about Xenu, the evil intergalactic overlord.
And the believers that I've shared this with, you know, I mean, they've had some different reactions to it. So, you know, you've kind of expect that an outsider is going to get some things wrong, you know, like I doubt the missionaries actually said to her, oh, he looked into a hat. I mean, that's not something that missionaries really say. So a believer is going to listen to that and they might, you know, discount what she's saying a little bit so they don't have to take it so seriously. But, you know, when she gets so many things right, like she does, then, you know, you kind of get this reaction sometimes like, well, I wonder why she's not Mormon, because, you know, how is it that somebody could know the truth and not be Mormon, right? You know, because it's just the thing that keeps the whole world from being Mormon is just how misunderstood the church is, right? But, you know, to me, the best thing about this story is the empathy that she shows, you know, towards the missionaries, because, yeah, she ridicules them about the story that she hears, but then she turns it onto herself and she shows some honesty and some integrity to put that microscope on her own beliefs and really start looking closely at how an outsider would hear what has been insider information for her whole life. So, you know, I've had believers that I've shared this with, and they come away being able to do kind of the same thing for their own Mormon beliefs.
Okay, so I was initially felt really superior to these boys and smug in my more conventional faith. But then the more I thought about it, the more I had to be honest with myself. I mean, if someone came to my door and I was hearing Catholic theology and dogma for the very first time, and they said, we believe that God impregnated a very young girl without the use of intercourse, and the fact that she was a virgin is maniacally important to us, and she had a baby, and that's the Son of God, I would have thought that was equally ridiculous. I'm just so used to that story. So I couldn't let myself feel condescending towards these boys.
I think that's huge. Like the, I think of it as like an intellectual kind of triangulation. When you can look at something else that's analogous, and analyze it in a way that you wouldn't be able to look at your own beliefs, you know, because you have this protection that you put around what you're used to, and when you're able to kind of deconstruct it, deconstruct something else, that gives you the tools or the practice that. At doing that with your own beliefs, it kind of forces you to be self-reflective.
Yeah, there's actually a guy that wrote a book. I can't remember his name, but he called it the Outsider's Test. It's an intellectual exercise to say, okay, what are my beliefs? How would these beliefs look like to an outsider? For most Mormons, they're probably incapable of undergoing this intellectual exercise. But what I find interesting is that with all believers, when they look at other people's beliefs, it's so easy to see the holes. It's so easy to dismiss. It's so easy to find it absurd. But what Julia Sweeney did was, like, you know, when the missionaries left, she's like, they're so silly. But then she turned the outsider, you know, how would my beliefs in, you know, a virgin birth and transubstantiation and all the Catholic beliefs look like to someone who wasn't raised in it themselves? And she had an epiphany in that moment.
And she also recognized in those missionaries herself as a young girl who wanted at one point to grow up to be a nun, and that, you know, like religious desire. So she was able to make that connection to herself.
That's exactly what Dawkins is doing here. I mean, when he points out, you know, one of his criticisms that he points out about the Book of Mormon is just look at the language. I mean, it's using 16th century language in a 19th century book, you know, and for an outsider, that's just an obvious fraud. Like, why would...
Well, but he's not empathizing in any way. You know,
he's not the way Julia Sweeney was. But think about, I know he's not, but I'm saying for outsiders, they can look at it at a much more basic level. Like, rather than talking about, you know, Book of Mormon geography and DNA haplogroups and crap like that, I mean, just think about, look at the language of it. If a person in the 19th century were translating a document that was from 1,000 years prior in America, why on earth would they use, and it came to pass, and why would they use?
The reason why Joseph Smith or whoever wrote the Book of Mormon, Sidney Rigdon, whoever, what else is written in 16th century English?
Yeah.
Well, right.
The King James Version.
It sounds analogous to the Bible that they were using, but...
Right. So to give it more of a scriptural, you know, this is a classic pseudepigrapha. To give it more of a scripture feel, they used what was scriptural language of the 19th century, which is just what exactly a fraud would do.
Well, yeah, but I mean... Even a believer hearing that argument, it would be so easy to dismiss, because it's not, if you can accept that God is giving an inspired translation, you can also accept that he's doing it intentionally in this language of King James, you know.
That's my whole point, is that someone who is on the outside is going to look at these things like a misdemeanor conviction from 1826 or the King James, you know, whatever it is, the Edwardian language of it, and they're gonna see that as just sticking out like a sore thumb. Whereas somebody who's been raised with, you know, being used to that, to them it's just, oh well, that's, you know, it's no big deal.
But see, I mean, and this is where I kind of take issue with Dawkins, because he calls it an obvious fraud. Well, to him, being an outsider, it's obvious. But is he trying to empathize with the believer and go, you know what? It's not so obvious to a believer. So is that really the best choice of words to call it an obvious fraud? What are you really doing when you're using that word?
Well, his audience isn't Mormons that he's trying to...
He's not trying to win over Mormons. When he directly looks at Brandon Flowers and says, you obviously, or, you know, you believe in this obvious fraud.
Yeah, he's not trying to win over the Mormons with that. He's trying to win over the crowd and the 99.9% of other people in the world who aren't Mormons. He's trying to make a point about religion more generally and using Mormonism as an example of that.
Yeah.
That's what I think, but...
I'm going to jump in here and take some editorial license here, okay? So I wasn't able to articulate this point very well during the course of the discussion with Jesse and Randy, but as I'm listening back to it, the thing that I take issue with Dawkins and other people who take this approach, they say things like, oh, this is such an obvious fraud. And what they're implying, and even what Dawkins asked Flowers directly is, you know, how can you possibly believe this? You know, they're implying there's no rational reason why anyone in the world would believe such rubbish, such nonsense. And to me, I think that's just categorically untrue, and I think it's turning a blind eye to all of the reasons why someone would believe something like this. That, yeah, to them it might be an obvious fraud, but if you look closer, what's under the surface, why would a believer believe what they believe? And I think there are a lot of valid reasons for that that are just being ignored. That's where I take issue. I didn't say that in the course of the discussion, but I get to say it right here, right now. I'm so happy for me.
As a outspoken atheist, I think this is kind of the reason why you wanted to do this podcast, was Richard Dawkins out of line? But to make it like on a personal thing, to take it to a personal level, this is not something I would ever do. I would never see a true believer and just attack them unprovoked, really, directly like that. Now, if somebody confronts me that's a believer, they're going to get, you know, the full court press. But what I do believe I should do is do things like this podcast, you know, write things, you know, say if I want to start a blog, write a blog that shows the silliness of Mormonism. That way, if somebody comes across it, they have to go find it and then have to make the decision to read it or not, or to download the podcast and listen to it or not. And that way, my opinion isn't kind of thrust in their face. I just don't think, first of all, it's not effective, because people will retrench when directly attacked. When you're attacking their whole worldview in that situation. So I can understand criticism of Dawkins. You're right, Glenn, he wasn't empathetic, and he just kind of attacked a guy who was there to sing a song, not to have his faith questioned. But at the same time,
that's the other question with this video. I mean, why is Dawkins even there?
Yeah.
It's like they bring out Brandon Flowers, and then it's like the Jerry Springer episode where they bring out, you know, the girl that his wife's been sleeping with or something. And
yeah.
And the host, I didn't like the host. The host really did instigate it. He's like, you know, how could you? I mean, you know, we just had Brandon here.
Yeah.
Talk about the beauty of faith.
Exactly.
Why can't you understand the beauty of faith? And it's like, Dawkins was under direct attack at the same time.
Yeah.
And that led to Dawkins then turning to Brandon Flowers and being unempathetic and kind of in direct attack mode.
Yeah. There was something that you had said earlier, Randy, about the way that Mormons perceive a non-Mormon perception of them.
Mm-hmm.
There was a DVD that's kind of like a man on the street interview approach that I never saw, but I saw the commercials or I saw the previews for it. It was the guy who was in Singles Ward that I think his name was Dallin. You know, he was the Franklin Planner guy.
Yeah.
And so that guy, I guess he's like kind of a comedian in real life, maybe. I don't know. I don't see him with his own podcast. But he went out on the street and was like interviewing people. What do you think of Mormons?
What do you know about the Mormons? What have you heard? What do you know about the Mormons? So what's a Mormon?
What's a Mormon? I don't know.
Crazy religious group.
Crazy religious group. How, you know, what makes the Mormons different than any other religion you've seen?
They try to stay to the old ways of life.
The multiple wife thing is cool. I think it's cool.
Anything Mormons are allowed to do, not allowed to do.
I don't think dancing is good. They don't watch TV.
They don't watch TV?
They're not allowed to smoke. Not allowed to premarital sex. Not allowed to drink.
Amusement rides.
So no Disneyland for the Mormons.
They certainly don't have computers or phones.
Can they use microphones? Joseph Smith.
He was a Mormon. The first Mormon, maybe?
John Smith, Jim Smith.
What was the name of the prophet?
No idea.
Jacob Smith?
Almost. If I said it, would you know it?
Yeah. Joe?
Yes.
Smith?
Nick Mo?
No.
Joseph Smith?
Joseph Smith?
No.
Huh. You know anyone famous that's a Mormon?
The Osmonds.
The Osmonds?
Yes.
Steve Young?
Yep.
Steve Martin?
The comedian.
Maybe.
He's a comedian.
Because he did that movie where there's like 12 kids cheaper by the dozen.
He's Mormon?
No.
What message is he trying to promote to his Mormon audience about the way that non-Mormons view Mormons?
It's probably to show that the only reason people think poorly of Mormons is because they're completely ignorant.
Right. Yeah. Total idiots.
You could put in some of the Book of Mormon South Park episode.
Yeah, so well, I mean, we might as well talk about that. Where were you guys at in your faith journey when you first saw that?
You know, I didn't see that until after my faith crisis. I'd watched South Park sporadically, and I'd seen, I think I saw Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
Wow, but, really?
Yeah, and they didn't. I kind of liked South Park, but you know, it was always kind of the guilty pleasure. But I never saw that episode until after my faith crisis. So at that point, I thought it was great, but I don't know what I would have thought about it beforehand. I probably would have just dismissed it as being, you know, this fictional account, like, oh boy, that's funny. They don't even know what they're talking about.
I didn't see it till I was long gone.
Huh.
But I was always a guilty fan of South Park. Well, I was when I was at BYU. And I could handle the raunchiness, but then they started to make fun of my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And I couldn't abide that.
Yeah.
So I ended up stopping watching South Park about the time they started to have Jesus as the guy that was at the local, like lived in town.
Yeah.
And I thought it was too irreverent.
I used to have reactions like that. Like I remember there was a Saturday Night Live skit once with Phil Hartman where he dressed up as Jesus. And I loved everything Phil Hartman ever did, but I couldn't get past that. I just had to turn it off. And even, you know, I'm a big Beatles fan. I love all the Beatles stuff, but they've got that song, The Ballad of John and Yoko, where John says, "Christ, you know it ain't easy. They're going to crucify me." And I always thought that was so sacrilegious. I would just skip it. I couldn't do it. You know, now it doesn't bother me at all. But the South Park episode for me, I think that was the first time that I ever came across the hat thing. I don't know that I had heard of it before. And it also introduced a new way to interpret that Lucy Harris lost 116-page manuscript story.
Because he hasn't heard the best part about the Joseph Smith story, the one that proves he was for real.
Yeah!
Ooh, what's that? Well, you remember Martin Harris, the rich man who wrote down what Joseph Smith read out of the hat?
Yeah.
See, after he was done, he took some of the pages of what would become the Book of Mormon home.
Martin went home to his wife, dum 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 dum, and showed her pages from the Book of Mormon, dum 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 dum.
And so Joseph Smith put his head into a hat and read to me what the golden plate said. I wrote it all down, and we're going to publish it into a book.
Martin, how do you know he isn't just making stuff up and pretending he's translating off golden plates?
Lucy Harris, smart, 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 smart.
Why would he make it up?
Martin Harris, dum dum.
All right, here. I'm going to hide these pages. If Joseph Smith really is translating off of golden plates, then he'll be able to do it again. But if Joseph Smith is making it all up, then the new translations will be different from these.
Okay, fine. I bet he'll have no problem.
Lucy Harris, smart, smart, smart. Martin Harris, dumb. So Martin went on back to Smith, said the pages had gone away. Smith got mad and told Martin he needed to go pray. Dum, 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 dum.
Look, I'm sorry about losing the pages we worked on, Joe, but I'm ready to write it all down again if you translate from the plates.
I would love to, Martin. Except, I just had a vision. And the Lord said he is very angry with me for letting you take those pages.
He is?
Dum, 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 dum.
Yes, he is so mad that he will never let me translate from the plate of Lehi again. He said we must now translate from the plate of Nephi. So it will be the same basic story, but written a little differently.
Wow! If God got angry with you, then you must be telling the truth.
Dum, 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 dum.
All right, Martin, let's get to work.
And that's how it happened.
Yeah!
All right!
Wait, Mormons actually know this story and they still believe Joseph Smith was a prophet?
Well, sure. The story proves it, doesn't it?
No, it proves he did make it all up. Are you blind?
That was a huge influence on me. Because, you know, growing up in the church, you hear this story about Lucy Harris and the lost 116 pages of the Book of Mormon, and it's all about how God had the foresight in 600 BC to know that she was going to steal these 116 pages and that she was going to try and doctor them to make Joseph look bad. So, you know, she'd take them and then Joseph Smith would redo it exactly the way he had done the first time. And then she'd bring out this doctored version and then compare it side by side and be like, oh, no, look, he's a fraud. And God knew that was going to happen way back in 600 BC. So he told Nephi to write down everything that he had written down already on these large plates of you know, brass or golden plates, whatever they were, and make this summary document so that Joseph Smith could translate from that, and it wouldn't have to match up with the first one. And that's how God knew. And, you know, that's just what I heard growing up, and I accepted it because, you know, one of the main themes in the Book of Mormon is, I will go and do the things that the Lord commands, you know, even if I don't understand why he's commanding it. And so this story was used like evidence that God can see in the big picture, even if I can't. And so we just trust, right? But this South Park episode, it just kind of like knocked me on the side of the head and said, duh. So there you go. Insiders listening to outsiders until they become outsiders themselves. It's kind of sad. And kind of not. Anyone for the closing prayer?